Hello again, I'm Warren Olney. Robots are here to stay, in factories and homes, from real-world battlefields to popular culture. Later on To the Point, we'll talk about the robotics and the increased interaction of robots with human beings. First, this story, Broadway is on fire. That's according to Carol Schatz of L.A. Central City Association. The latest example is conversion of the Rialto Theater into a new store for Urban Outfitters, the upscale clothing chain from Philadelphia. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez has been watching the reinvention of downtown L.A. It hasn't caught fire yet, but it is on fire in another way.
It's smoldering, Warren, and I'm freshly back from Broadway. I was just there earlier in the day, walked the entire length of the historic core. That's about 9 blocks. Let's situate where we're talking about Broadway, from about Broadway and First over to Broadway and Olympic, and that's called the historic core of downtown Los Angeles. And let's talk about why we want to talk about this street. For decades, L.A. was Broadway, essentially, where, you know, where when so much of L.A. was just empty farm fields and fields back in the 20s and the early 20th century, Broadway was already a hustling, bustling place. You know, it looked more like Chicago and New York than the rest of L.A. This is where L.A. had its largest department stores, its most opulent movie theaters. Actually, it predates movie theaters. They were Nickelodeons and they were vaudeville theaters first. And it was the crossroads of the city. That changed. There was suburban flight. The valley opened up for business and, you know, suburbia grew there. The city grew westward. A lot of Broadway lost its energy. But then it was rediscovered by L.A.'s booming Latino community in the 70s and 80s on into the 90s. And now there's another reinvention in the midst, and it's become hip, and it's become a place where a lot of hip companies, stylish companies, want to go, and a lot of stylish people want to work and want to live. And one of those is Lisa Foote, who I met just yesterday when I made an earlier visit there.
Every week I could see it, you know, getting better and better, and people are coming back for our stuff, and we have some celebrity clientele, and it's going great, I'd say.
What are these new stores opening up mean to you? Urban Outfitters and Acme, the Swedish company, and, you know, everything else around it. Is that good or bad?
I personally think it's good. I'm from a city where, you know, shopping is, you know, really prevalent, and I think more than one store brings more than one people. We offer something that Urban Outfitters doesn't. We offer something that all, you know, everyone has their individual fit and their niche, and I think the more people that come downtown and that, you know, are exposed to it, are seeing, like, wow, it's not what it used to be. We're not going to get mugged. There is parking. It is a great place. There are great places to eat. There's great people from all over the world. There's tourists. I'm meeting people from France, England, New York, Germany, Amsterdam. I mean, you know, it's a nice nucleus for people who are used to cosmopolitan cities. I think it's great. I say the more the merrier, and bring it on.
So what about gentrification? There are people already there. This woman is from someplace else.
There are people already there, and this is not – a couple of weeks ago, we talked about Westwood Village, Warren, and it's some of its issues as it tries to rediscover itself and reorient itself in the 21st century. The thing with Broadway, it's always been a thriving street. As I said earlier, once kind of a largely Anglo clientele left, the Latinos moved in, and it was the place to go shopping for groceries at Central Market, or to get a wedding dress for your daughter, or to buy inexpensive jewelry or electronic goods. And now we have these new arrivals. We talked about Urban Outfitters. There's also, as was mentioned in that bite, there's also Ace Hotel, which is going into the United Artist Theater on the south side of Broadway. There's this Swedish clothing company, Acne, which is going in. Right next to it, a Pilates shop. Right next to it, you know, a restaurant. There's just so much activity. And then I think the feeling, though, among people who've been there and who've been selling goods is, are we still going to be welcome in this place? Is there still a place for us here? And will we be able to survive, frankly, if rents go up? And I talked about that with Luis Ivanez. He's a man. He sells shoes a couple of doors down from Urban Outfitters. And this is what he had to say about the worries of merchants.
Obviously, it's a risk.
It's a risk.
It's a risk for the owners of the stores, because they have definitely invested more money to improve the stores, and obviously a lot of smaller stores they have to close because they don't have the budget. This is a big concern, obviously, for the small stores, for the small businesses and Broadway.
So he's worried about the rent going up.
Worried about the rent going up. And these are very successful merchants, particularly in the 1990s. They say that storefront rents were equal to West LA on Broadway in the 1990s per square foot, like $6-7 per square foot.
Because they had volume.
Because they had volume of business. Yeah. Lots of people came, particularly on the weekend. This was a good place to own a business. But as, you know, the hippification occurs of Broadway, you see sort of the life leeching out of these places. There are a couple of big arcades between Broadway and Spring Street, and those are largely dead zones now.
You mentioned the Central Market. That's sort of unrecognizable, isn't it?
It's in the process of reinventing itself. I mean, there's still a lot of the old Central Market there. But again, I was there earlier this week, and you wherever you turn, you see, you know, stalls being reoccupied by high-end vendors of people who are moving in from their very successful gourmet food truck operations to, like, opening up, you know, places there in the market. And it's very interesting when you walk through, when you have, you know, kind of the young stylish ones gathered around the new places and the more traditional market clientele around the old places. And I was talking to someone I know at the market, and he says, you know, that trend, not that particular trend, they want everybody to be there. But, you know, there's going to be new vendors moving in. There's going to be an increasingly new look to the market. So that's another change. Another challenge very quickly, Warren, is, you know, we've been talking about the first floor. We've been talking about the ground level of Broadway. There's 1 million square feet of vacant office space above Broadway. There are new rules in place that have been introduced to start getting people into those vacant areas. These are buildings, you know, these buildings were built when there was a Kaiser in Germany, when there was a Czar in Russia. I mean, they're ancient by LA standards, but they, you know, they don't comply with current fire rules and construction rules.
So the new standards have come out.
The new standards are out to allow some wiggle room there where you don't have to replace the stairwells, for instance, for certain kinds of places, of merchants or, you know, people opening up shop there. They're envisioning things
so
like...
So what would occupy the space?
Small tech companies, Pilates shops, yoga studios, things like that, you know, kind of like the new economy, the information economy folks would move in there. But it is an enormous... I mean, really, when you talk about the ground level, you're just scratching the surface. You walk down Broadway and you look up. It's cobwebbed room after cobwebbed room, which, you know, looks like it's been vaulted off since the 1960s or 50s.
So with these new guidelines, you know, would the buildings be safe and
the idea
particularly
is,
from fire and other such things?
Well, the idea is there's a happy medium. There's a way to revive.
Earthquakes.
There's a way to revive them while also, you know, making sure that they're safe. And then another thing coming up on Broadway is the streetcar that's planned for the area. That's coming in, wildly different cost estimates from $150 million to $320, $30 million about how much this is going to cost. Another initiative to relight all the beautiful neon lights, all of them along Broadway. That's another big change that might be coming down the pike. And of course, you know, one other thing, Warren, that's really interesting about this place is that it's a place where rich and poor Angelenos come together in a way now that you don't see in other parts of the city.
That's one of the very interesting things about it, it seems to me. And well, maybe we'll be talking who knows how long from now about whether this is a bubble.
Let's continue the conversation about Broadway and other places.
Saul Gonzalez, always good to have you with us.
Thanks, Warren.
For pictures of the new developments on Broadway, you can go to kcrw.com/whichwayla blog. In a moment, new battles in California's water wars on Which Way LA.
You're listening to Which Way LA from KCRW. Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/whichwayla or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter at WWLA.
Warren Olnebeck with Which Way LA. California's definitive problem is the shortage of water, brought to public consciousness once again by this third year of diminished rainfall and new battles in the ongoing water wars. Politicians are demanding a drought declaration. Governor Brown wants $25 billion for two new tunnels to help bring water from north to south. And San Diego has gone to court against the Metropolitan Water District, which delivers water to 20 million people. We'll start there with Jim Carlton with the Wall Street Journal in San Francisco, where the case is being tried. Jim, good to have you on our program.
Yeah, hi, Warren. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. So what is San Diego suing the MWD for?
Well, essentially, San Diego is claiming they're being gouged by the Metropolitan Water District. This all goes back to 20 years ago when San Diego says that the Met cut off 30% of their water during a very dry year, and that caused all kinds of economic calamity. As a result, they moved to diversify their water sources, and so they started getting more water from the Imperial Irrigation District out in the desert, but they have to use the MWD infrastructure pipelines to transport to San Diego. So they say that basically MWD is charging an exorbitant tax on that, and that's why they're going to court.
Okay. The MWD represents not just San Diego, but a much larger district than that. What happens to them if San Diego wins the case?
Well, San Diego is seeking up to almost $200 million in refunds from alleged overcharges. If MWD loses, they told me, well, we can't pay for that, our member agencies will. And so that means Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, San Bernardino, Orange County. I mean, you know, there's like 25 other member agencies. So basically it's going to mean higher rates for Southern California ratepayers.
Jim Carlton in San Francisco for the Wall Street Journal. David Nahai is former general manager of the DWP in Los Angeles, the Department of Water and Power. He's now president of David Nahai Consulting and a practicing attorney. Good to have you back on our program.
Thank you, Warren. It's good to be with you again.
How much water does the city of Los Angeles get from the MWD rather than from the Owens Valley?
It varies. Right now, it probably veers somewhere between 50 to 70%, depending. Now, remember, about 90% of our water comes from outside the city. About probably, 30% from the Owens Valley, maybe 50 to 60% from MWD, and the other about 10% from our own local aquifer in the San Fernando Valley, and about 1 or 2% from recycled water.
So the point is then that there's going to be a shocking price increase in Los Angeles as well as in all the other places served by the MWD if the San Diego wins this case.
Certainly MWD, if it loses this case, and this is the problem with litigation, right? You can lose. If MWD does lose, then this cost will have to be spread amongst the other member agencies. But I think the repercussions are bigger than that. $200 million is a lot of money, but when you consider, the size of MWD and 20 million people, 26 member agencies. One could argue that as large as that is, it's absorbable. I think the bigger issue, though, is that it will change the way MWD will charge its member agencies in the future, and there could be very wide implications from that. And this is happening, by the way, at a time when member agencies are trying to reduce their reliance on MWD water by pursuing local water programs, including Los Angeles, and this is happening against the backdrop of this project in the Delta, which could cost, as we've heard, around $25 billion, and a lot of that cost is going to have to be absorbed by MWD as well, perhaps up to a quarter of it. And so the question then is going to become, as member agencies reduce their reliance on MWD, and if San Diego wins this lawsuit and therefore we have a change in how member agencies are going to be charged as a result of all of this, what will that portend for the future?
So the governor wants $25 billion for his project. The MWD is pledged to pay 25% of that. But if they lose the suit to San Diego and have to begin changing the way that they charge money, they're not going to be able to make good on that pledge.
Well, we'll have to see what the future holds. I mean, none of us can prejudge how the court will act. But I think what this does tell us is that for us here in Los Angeles, moving towards local water, away from this model of depending so heavily on imported water. The days when imported water was cheap and plentiful, those days are over. And so we've got to plan for our future here in this city. And this, of course, leads to a conversation about rates and where the money is going to come from to deal with all of this. It certainly does paint a picture of uncertainty at this time and the need to plan and invest very carefully.
Many questions about where the money comes from, but plenty of questions as well about where the water comes from. Robert Gottlieb is a professor of urban and environmental policy at Occidental College. He was a board member at one time of the MWD, the Municipal Water District. Bob Gottlieb, good to have you on our show.
Good to be here, Warren.
Where did San Diego go? Well, we heard that it went to the Imperial Water District in the east part of the state. But where are other districts going to go to find more water? Is there more water?
Well, it depends what you mean by having more water. You could, for years, San Diego included, the idea of more water was imported water, was going to more distant places to bring in water. And at the same time, kind of not really paying attention to both the local water that was available that was increasingly becoming suspect because of contamination problems, or thinking perhaps most importantly about how water was actually used itself, the demand side, how you could restructure and really come to terms with the kind of region that we live in, which is one that gets erratic rainfall. It can be as little as a few inches a year, and it could be 30 inches a year and cause lots of flooding. But over time, there's a limited supply to deal with that is local. So you have to think, how do you really reorient the way that water gets used, whether it's landscape issues, whether it's the idea that you can continue to annex new areas that are water short and build your ever-expanding region, and you'll always be able to provide the resources for those new developments out in the desert. Those kinds of approaches have to change. And San Diego itself is a good example. As this lawsuit moves forward, they're actively pursuing yet new annexations that extend the need for more water in their region.
Back to Jim Carlton with the Wall Street Journal. The case has just begun to be argued in San Francisco, but is the MWD bringing up those kinds of questions, or have they done so in any of the preliminary documents?
Well, it's all kind of being worked out right now in the courtroom. But I just might add that, I mean, at stake here also is, we've talked about the Bay Delta Conservation Project, you know, Governor Brown's $25 billion plan.
That's the one that involves the two tunnels, enormous right. tunnels, 40 feet across and 30 miles long.
Right, exactly. This is a huge project they're trying to, and it faces enormous opposition up here in Northern California. I mean, there's, you know, farmers versus farmers, environmentalists versus environmentalists. But in Southern California, that's where you're supposed to get the kind of the consensus. And if you got San Diego kind of off the reservation, and I talked to the general manager, or the assistant general manager of the San Diego County Water Authority the other day, and said, do you guys support the BDCP? And he said, he kind of paused and said, well, we support the concept of there needs to be a fix to the delta. As far as this project, it's still a wait and see. And so what he's saying is they feel like they're already paying too much. They are the largest single agency that deals with MWD. They're a big customer. Will they try to use their muscle if they win this case to try to, better terms and then thereby, you know, hurt this this bigger Delta project? Who knows? So there's, David said, there's a lot of larger issues here, more than just the, race in Southern California.
So, David Nahai, back to you, former manager of the DWP. This, it seems to me, just suggests that if it's not this case, it's going to be some other that increases the pressure on the water supply in Southern California. So when you say there's local water and we should go for a different water than we're getting from the MWD, where do we go? Where is that water and what condition is it in?
Well, we have lots of options, and I'll go through them in just a second. What we need is the political wherewithal and quite frankly, the leadership to make the necessary investments. And by the way, we haven't even talked about climate change and the kind of impact that is going to have. You know, I mean, it's wonderful to have rain here in the basin, but it's really the snowpack in the eastern Sierras that we depend upon. And climate change, all indications are, is going to vary the patterns of the snowpack. It's already erratic. We're going to get snowbelt in a different pattern and manner than we have in the past. And you know, that also impacts what is going to happen with respect to the Bay Delta and whether we can expect to get as much water as we have previously, even with the construction of the two tunnels, if this project goes forward.
So what are these alternatives?
Okay. There, in my book, there are 7 or 8 of them. First, more conservation. We've done very well in the city of Los Angeles, and I think we can truly pat ourselves on the back. Added 1 million people, water consumption has actually declined. So we've done very well. We can do better. Next, wastewater recycling. We recycle a small percentage of our own wastewater right now. We can do very well with that, and the department has got very sound plans in order to do that. Cleaning up our aquifer in the San Fernando Valley. We get about 10% of our water from the San Fernando Valley aquifer. It is, however, suffering from contamination. This is a resource that we're seeing slowly vanish before our very eyes, and it's something that we cannot.
The aquifer is underground water. How do you clean it up?
Oh, there are numerous treatment options, and the department has actually been looking at a sizable project in order to basically the water is brought up, it is cleaned, it is reinjected. Now, this isn't present contamination. These are legacy pollutants that we're dealing with. But again, the technology, the plans, the ways to do that is available to us. We just have to make the investment.
Okay, let me go back to Professor Gottlieb at Occidental, also a former member of the MWD. You're really not speaking in that capacity anymore. It's been a long time since you've been on the MWD. But do you agree with David Nahai that all of these sources could be developed and that they would make a sufficient difference? That we might not have to have the two tunnels leading down, bringing the water down from Northern California? Where would we get if we tapped those new sources?
Well, I think the 7 sources that David mentioned are all important ones. They require policies, not simply exhortation. There are others, in addition, focused on the largest share of water that's used has to do with outdoor water use, landscape. There could be additional innovations and policies that you'd establish in terms of any new construction, for example.
Would they all end up being cheaper than getting water? Presumably, let's assume for the moment that San Diego wins the case and water rates go up from the water that we buy from the MWD. Would all those other sources be able to supply water, replace that MWD water, and be cheaper for ratepayers?
Well, most of them are far cheaper, obviously, because you're really talking about changing practices rather than building new infrastructure. But I think there needs to be a distinction between what would be, you know, your ongoing policies that need to be developed, that stretch your water, that change the way it's used, as well as policies that deal with what you could call dry year conservation or dry year use. When you have climate impacts, when you do have that exceptionally dry year, and what's ironic about the San Diego case is it really got stimulated by a policy that was across the board. It wasn't just San Diego. It was across the board within all metropolitan agencies in a sequence of dry years to cut back across the board in the amount of water that would be available, which really would require cutting back on use. That's the realities that we're also facing. We have to operate on what are the ongoing programs that are going to stretch the water, as well as what happens in those exceptional years.
That's all. I'm sorry to interrupt you. That's all the time we have for the conversation now. We'll have further conversations as time goes on, particularly with regard to whether we have a drought or not and what that might mean if a formal drought is declared, and the effects of climate change, of course, are with us at all times as well. Bob Gottlieb, a professor at Occidental College, David Nahai, formerly with the DWP, Jim Carlton with the Wall Street Journal in San Francisco. Thank you all very much for being on our program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Remember, you can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, the world of robots in love and war on To the Point.